Shalom, Hadavarniks. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministries and our School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the prophet Ezekiel. This is the 2022 edition. And we're in session 26. Session 26 begins in chapter 28, verse 1. So let's review where we were last sessions, in previous sessions. First of all, we were reviewing the nations that surround Israel and the judgment God was going to bring on these nations. Ammon, Moab, Edom, Philistia, Tyre, Sidon, and Egypt. So last session we were dealing with the country of Tyre. And we saw that Tyre would be attacked by wave after wave of conquerors. Babylon, Persia, Greece, the Ptolemies, Seleucids, Rome, and now the Arabs occupy that area. They would be attacked by wave after wave of armies, just as the sea brought wave after wave of water against the rocks, over and over and over again. And that was a very appropriate symbol for Tyre, because Tyre was not only a coastal city on the coast of the Mediterranean, but she was also an island city. And here is the island component of Tyre. This is where the citadel was located, the headquarters of Tyre, safely a half mile off the beach. Now, God said that he would bring Nebuchadnezzar upon Tyre, and that means Nebuchadnezzar had to cross over the top of the Fertile Crescent and bring his armies then down upon Tyre from the north. Now, after Nebuchadnezzar attacked Tyre, it took him 13 years of siege before he conquered the coastal city. 13 years of siege. He was followed by the Persians. Now, Nebuchadnezzar could not conquer the island citadel. The Persians could not conquer the island citadel. And then along came the Greeks under Alexander the Great. And he had a novel idea. He said, let's take all the rubble from the coastal city and we'll make a bridge across that half mile over to the island of Tyre. So he built this causeway, and his troops came across the causeway and did conquer the island city of Tyre. But after wave after wave after wave of conquest, God eventually said Tyre would be no more, it would not be rebuilt. And yet we see here in this picture that modern Tyre very exists. And so how do you explain the fact that God says Tyre will never be rebuilt with the fact that there's a modern Tyre? Well, the conventional explanation goes this way, that this area is filled with archaeological ruins and that nothing's been built on those ruins, and the city itself is pretty much gone because Alexander made a causeway out of it. So that's the fulfillment of the verse. I presented you with a better option later on in the class. We move then into chapter 27. In chapter 27, Tyre was compared to a beautiful, beautiful ship. Magnificent ship with the best rowers, the best pilots, the best businessmen, the best businessmen in the world, the best ship in the world, highest quality. And that was a nice symbol of Tyre, because her fleet of ships, plied the Mediterranean Sea. And they went all the way from Tyre, clear down the Mediterranean to Tarsus, or the Tartessus in Spain. And this was one of their trading colonies. And they had trading colonies in between those two points. Now, many of the trading partners are listed in the chapter. The first one was Yavan. This is the Greeks. And Yavan, very clearly we know which where that was located. We're not so sure where others were located. Tubal is thought to be in central Turkey. Meshech, another trading partner, is thought to be in western Turkey. Togarma, Beit Togarma, is thought to be in modern Armenia today. Now, Dedan, down in the lower left corner. We don't know where Dedan was located, but from a description of its products, it's thought that probably a North African location would be good. Some location on the African continent up against the Mediterranean coast. Syria was a trading partner with Tyre. She was just north of Tyre. Just south of Tyre is Judah and Israel. They were trading partners with Tyre, and they were also competitors to Tyre. Damascus was a very major city, a great city, located to the east of Tyre. Very important trading partner, I'm sure. Now, Vedan. We don't know where Vedan was located. Some think it was in the Arabian Peninsula, but we really don't know. The next trading partner is Yavan. Now, this is not the Yavan, that's Greece. Again, we don't know where this Yavan was located. Again, some think it was in the Arabian Peninsula. Dedan. Now, this is not the Dedan in Africa. We know there was Arabic tribes in the Arabic Peninsula named Dedan. So this is probably an Arab tribe in the Arabic Peninsula. And then there's Arabia and Kedar. That's a reference to the tribes, the Bedouin tribes in the Arabian Peninsula. They came north with caravans to trade with Tyre, just as the others came from the north and from the east with their caravans to Tyre. Now, way, way down at the south end of the Arabian Peninsula, we know that Sheba and Ra'ama were located, and they would send their caravans up north to Tyre. Now, finally, we come to Mesopotamia, which is just a generic term for the peoples to the east of the Euphrates River. So I compared the good ship Tyre to the RMS Titanic. The Titanic was similar. It was new. It was big. It dominated the idea of a steamship. It was the most modern steamship of its day. And a lot of hype was made around the Titanic. And it left Europe. I think this is England. It pulled out of England with a great celebration. And then it headed across the Atlantic at high speed. It was doing great. But everything that made it great, all its workmanship, all its modern accessories, everything that was good about it, could not keep it from sinking. She hit that iceberg, and down went the RMS Titanic. And the same was true with the great ship Tyre, the GS Tyre, the great ship Tyre. Nothing, all her advantages, all her power, all her wealth could not keep her afloat. And eventually down she went, and those associated with her had to dive into the lifeboats and abandon ship. And in doing so, they lamented highly. Well, then we move from chapter 27, verses 1 to 33 in the near future, and we jump to the tribulation period in verses 34 through 36, and that provided the explanation for the permanent destruction of Tyre. And Tyre exists today, so this means that her final and permanent destruction has to lie somewhere off in the future. So I suggest to you that it'll happen in the tribulation period. So that brings us to the new material. We've looked at the city of Tyre, the business of Tyre, and now we come to focus on an individual, the prince of Tyre, in chapter 28, verses 1 through 10. So we begin with verse 1 in our new formula, this formula allowing Ezekiel to speak. The word of the Lord came again to me, saying. So we have a new revelation, a new topic. And the sin of the prince of Tyre is the sin of pride. He is the addressee in verse 2. Son of man, say to the leader of Tyre, thus says the Lord God. Say to the leader or the prince of Tyre. Now, the leader or prince of Tyre would normally be addressed as the king. But God specifically tells Ezekiel to give him this lesser title, this lower title. So he doesn't call him Melech, king. He calls him Nagid, prince or leader. Now, why? This is because God wants to distinguish the prince of Tyre from the king of Tyre. The king of Tyre will show up in verses 11 through 19. And the king of Tyre is the real power behind Tyre's throne. The real power lies with an invisible being, not with a human being. Well, the current prince of Tyre, the human being that's in charge of Tyre at this point, is Et Baal. And so we move from the tribulation period in chapter 27 to chapter 28, verses 1 through 10. And we're in the near future because the destruction of Tyre will come in the near future. Now, Et-Baal committed the sin of self-deification, verse 2. Because your heart is lifted up and you have said, I am a god. I sit in the seat of gods, in the heart of the seas. Yet you are a man and not God, although you make your heart like the heart of God. Okay, because your heart is lifted up, the root cause here is pride. The result of pride was a claim to deity, and that was not only a claim to deity, but it was a claim to divine authority. So he thought a lot of himself. Now, it's his kingdom, his throne, is described as in the midst of the seas. This is a description of Tyre's island fortress. It was in the midst of the sea, a half mile off the coast in the Mediterranean. And this is also a reference to the sea lanes that made Tyre and gave its rulers great authority, because the ships of Tyre, the fleets of Tyre, traversed the entire Mediterranean Sea. And they established colonies. And all those little black dots you see there are the colonies they established. Some 56 colonies that gave Tyre its wealth and power. And then God says to the prince of Tyre, he tells him the truth of the matter. He says, you are a man, you are not God, though you set your heart to be God. Well, a lot of people even today act like Ethbaal and proclaim themselves to be God or want to be God. For example, I once went to this website called goddirect.org. Here's what I read. A friend said to me, I want to be one with God. This is the ultimate goal of my life. I answered, you are already one with God. It is already accomplished. You need not do anything but bring your consciousness to it. All you have to do is become clear on what it is that you have generationally and culturally inherited that blocks you from believing that you are one with God. If you can name it, you can change it. Little by little, block by block, you bring yourself into alignment with your truth. Not God's truth, your truth, human truth. That of being one with God. And being one with God, you are God. Well, a lot of people even today think like the king of Tyre. No matter how much you think so, you ain't God. Well, the king of Tyre was no dummy, however. He had wisdom that brought him tremendous economic success in verses 3 through 5. In fact, he's compared with Daniel in verse 3. Behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There's no secret that is a match for you. So Daniel was living at this time, and this shows how famous the wisdom of Daniel was. It was known throughout the ancient world, not only in Babylon, but clear over in Tyre as well. And the wisdom of Daniel is explained in a number of verses in the book of Daniel. For example, Daniel 1, verses 19 and 20. Now, this is during King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. The king, and that's Nebuchadnezzar, talked with them. And out of them all, not one was found like Daniel and his three friends now, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered into the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. So Nebuchadnezzar was impressed. And then also during Nebuchadnezzar's time is Daniel 2:48. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. So here, Daniel, so well known and so well respected, he has been promoted to a high, high government position. So the whole Middle East would have heard of Daniel. And then after Daniel's time, after Nebuchadnezzar was off the throne, and in Daniel 5:11 through 12 and 14, the queen is speaking to King Belshazzar. This is Nebuchadnezzar's successor. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because of an extraordinary spirit knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, the solving of difficult problems that were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. So he's well thought of. He's quite famous. And yet, it's possible here that the Prince of Tyre had greater wisdom than Daniel. Do you think that's possible? It says there was no secret hidden from him, and that refers to his ability to reveal secrets and solve riddles. And you know, Daniel had that ability too. A few verses to share from the book of Daniel. Daniel 2:47. This is again King Nebuchadnezzar, during King Nebuchadnezzar's time. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." So he was impressed by Daniel's ability to reveal that mystery. And then Daniel 4:9, again, the king, King Nebuchadnezzar says, "O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, since I know that a spirit of the holy gods is in you and no mystery baffles you, tell me the visions of my dream, which I have seen, along with its interpretation." So, you know, he respects Daniel's abilities and he seeks him out when he needs it. And then after Nebuchadnezzar's time, here we go again. Let's review those verses. Belshazzar's queen is speaking. This was because of an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems that were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. King Belshazzar is now speaking in verse 16. "But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as a third ruler of the kingdom." So, Daniel had great ability as well. Well, you know, there's two interpretive positions regarding verse 3. First of all, the Prince of Tyre's abilities in this area were superior to Daniel's. In fact, they were superior to Daniel's. So these people feel verse 3 is accurate, right on the money, accurate. But there's another view, and that view is that verse 3 is sarcastic, being a sarcastic response to Ethbaal's excessive arrogance, his excessive ego, his vanity. I don't think Ethbaal had greater wisdom than Daniel, because Daniel had God-given wisdom, not human wisdom. All Ethbaal had was human wisdom. So I go with the position that verse 3 is sarcastic, mocking Ethbaal. So Ethbaal might have over-exalted himself, but he was smart. I mean, there's no doubt that he had some brains. And the achievements of the Prince of Tyre's wisdom brought him, his human wisdom, brought him wealth in verses 4 and 5, starting in verse 4. "By your wisdom and understanding, you have acquired riches for yourself and have acquired gold and silver for your treasuries." So his sharp financial decisions brought him initial capital. Verse 5. "By your great wisdom, by your trade, you increased your riches, and this initial capital was reinvested in a merchant fleet. And the merchant fleet went from port to port to port, establishing colonies all around the Mediterranean Sea." And again, there's that map of those 56 colonies. And that brought great riches into Tyre. Now, that Hebrew word for wealth also means power. And power usually comes with wealth. It's the word chayil. So wealth and power. And the result of the wealth and power was pride. Verse 5. "And your heart was lifted up because of your riches." Because of your riches and all that came with it. And this in turn led to the self-deification in verse 2. And so the punishment of the Prince of Tyre is laid out in verses 6 through 10. Now this is a Gentile. So this punishment is not based on the Mosaic law. It's based on general revelation. General revelation that is revealed to us in Romans. Rabbi Shaul reveals this to us in Romans 1, 18 through 23. Now this is the punishment resulting from general revelation. This is what Ethbaal is under. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And that's exactly what Ethbaal did. He was living a lie. He was living a lie. Now, here's the content of God's general revelation. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. So mankind knows about God. Ethbaal is responsible to know about God. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so they are without excuse. So Ethbaal was without excuse when he thought he was equal with the true and living God. There's only one true and living God. It ain't Ethbaal. And so he is without excuse because he had general revelation. Now, here's man's responsibility in regard to general revelation. For even though they knew God, even though Ethbaal knew God, Ethbaal did not honor him as God or give thanks. You know, that's all God asks of us. Just respect me and give thanks. Just respect me and give thanks. That's all he asks. He's not a difficult father to love, that's for sure. So that's our responsibility. Ethbaal did not do this. And what was man's actual response? Ethbaal's actual response. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, and Ethbaal thought he was the top of the world there, they became fools. That's what he really was. And exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man. He worshipped himself. And of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. So, that's the sin. That's the sin. Based on general revelation. So the cause is in verse 6 again. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, because you have made your heart like the heart of God. There it is. Self-deification by a Gentile. Now, the prince of Tyre was very different from Daniel. Daniel glorified God. Ethbaal glorified himself. World of difference between those two men. And so the destruction of Tyre is outlined for us in verse 7. Therefore, behold, I will bring strangers upon you, the most ruthless of the nations, and they will draw their swords against the beauty of your wisdom and defile your splendor. So here the Babylonians are described. They're strangers. They're from way to the east over the Fertile Crescent. They're strangers and they're ruthless. That's a good description of the Babylonians. Ezekiel and Habakkuk describe them in a similar manner in their works. Ezekiel 30:11, the ruthless of nations. They are the most ruthless of nations. Ezekiel 30:11. Ezekiel 31:12, they're tyrants of the nations. Ezekiel 32:2, also tyrants of the nations. And then Habakkuk's opinion, they're fierce and impetuous. And all these are specific references to Babylon. So the result is the destruction of the coastal city, not the island city at this point. That will be destroyed later by Alexander the Great. So God says that they will draw their swords against the beauty of your wisdom. Ethbaal's wisdom will not be able to save his city. He was a smart guy. He was sharp. He was able to hold off Nebuchadnezzar for 13 years. But as God said, they shall defile your brightness. Eventually, Tyre's glory sunk into the sea. And then the death of the prince of Tyre is mentioned in verses 8 through 10. Specifically, his death in verse 8. They will bring you down to the pit. You will die the death of those who are slain in the heart of the seas. So the pit there is Sheol, the place of the dead. And that word death there is an intensive plural, so it signifies a violent death. So in the heart of the seas, he will violently die at the very place of his pride of power. He will die on the island city of Tyre, where his throne was located. And then God taunts Ethbaal in verse 9. Will you still say, I am a god, in the presence of your slayer, though you are man and no god, in the hands of those who wound you? So, will you still say that I am a god when you're standing face to face with a guy who has a sword to your throat? The answer is no, you're not going to be doing that. You're going to be cringing with fear. You're going to be begging for your life. But his death, Ethbaal's death, will prove that he's a man and that he's not God. He'll die at the hand of the person who dishonors and humiliates him. The nature of his execution is in verse 10. You will die the death of the uncircumcised by the hand of strangers, for I have spoken, declares the Lord God. So this is a description of the most disgraceful death possible. And the guarantee, I have spoken, declares the Lord God. So that's what happened to Ethbaal. All right, now we get to verse 11, and our attention is focused on the king of Tyre from verse 11 through 19. So we begin in verse 11 with our transition statement. Again, the word of the Lord came to me saying, so we have a new subject here. The new subject is the king of Tyre. And now we're going to change time frames. We were in the near future dealing with Ethbaal's upcoming death, but now we jump all the way back to the distant past, all the way back to the creation of the angels, which this is going way back in time, before the earth was even created. Now, verses 1 through 10 addressed a human king with the lesser title of prince. He was the leader of Tyre from a human perspective. But from God's perspective, there was a higher king. And so verses 9 through 11 are addressed to Satan, to Satan, who is the real king of Tyre. And the fact that there's an invisible king over the nations of the world is supported in the Brit Hadashah, the New Testament. For example, Luke 4:6, the devil said to Yeshua, to him, I will give you all this domain and its glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I will give it to whomever I trust. It was handed over to Satan when Adam and Eve fell. So he does have authority and dominion over the world. John 12:31, Jesus says, Now judgment is upon this world, and the ruler of this world is cast out. That's a reference to Satan, of course. He has authority over the world. Acts 26:18. Paul's mission is to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the dominion of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among those who've been sanctified by faith in me. So we're all trapped under Satan's dominion till we come to faith in Yeshua. 1 John 5:19. We know that we are of God and that the whole world, there it is, the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. He took that power away from Adam and Eve when he tricked them. 2 Corinthians 4:4. In whose case the God of this world, and again the emphasis is on the worldwide nature of Satan's authority, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving so they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Messiah, who is the image of God. Finally, we'll finish up with Ephesians 2, 1 and 2. And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. So Satan is very much alive and very much influential in this world of ours. Now, additional evidence for this change of object is the terminology going from prince to king. Ezekiel moves from a lesser title to a greater title, from Nagid to Melech, from Nagid to Melech. And the description that comes is beyond that of a mere man. This description cannot be that of Ethbaal. And this individual had a position with God that no man has ever attained. And finally, this individual was at first perfect and then sinned through pride. And the devil's pride and self-deification is revealed to us in Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14, 13 and 14. This is the five I wills of Satan. But you said in your heart, and notice it's in your heart. That's where sin begins. It begins in our hearts, inside us. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. And I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. So, Satan's arrogance led to self-deification, just like Ethbaal's did. Now, Ethbaal was never sinless and perfect. He can't possibly be this individual. But the prince of Tyre, Ethbaal, followed the same pattern as his predecessor, the king of Tyre. And this is the reason why the prince of Tyre is chosen to be the example. He's following the same route, the same path. He's walking in the same way as his father. And now God shares with us a lamentation. Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord God. So God laments the fall of Satan. The judgment of Satan was not a pleasurable thing for God to do. This is a funeral song, a dirge. Now God's attitude toward judgment is brought out in Ezekiel 33:11. Say to them, as I live, declares the Lord God, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn back from your evil ways. Why then will you die, O house of Israel? So God doesn't like judgment, but he has to judge because he's a righteous ruler. And evil and unrighteousness have to be disciplined and have to be taken care of and have to be removed. And so God, as a good judge, does the right thing, even though he doesn't like it. He judges sin. Now we come to a description and position of the king in verses 12 through 15. First of all, we get a glimpse of his wisdom and beauty, starting in verse 12. You had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Now the point here, the idea here, is to fill up or totally complete a pattern, to follow a blueprint, and to make something just like the blueprint says it should be made. So, first of all, Satan was perfect in physical form. There was a physical blueprint that God had put together, and so Satan, when he was created, physically filled up, he had physical perfection. He filled up that physical blueprint that God had for him. Second, he was full of wisdom. God had an intellectual blueprint in mind when he created Satan, and so Satan was the wisest of all created beings. Next, he was perfect in beauty. God had a beauty blueprint drawn for Satan. And the result, he was the most beautiful of all created beings. So he was physically and mentally the best of all created beings. Now, his description cannot be a description of Ethbaal. No way Ethbaal can fit that description. Now, Satan has a number of abodes, a number of places where we find him in position. And the first abode was near the throne of God. Now, if you'd like to look into this deeper, I would recommend you pick up the Messianic Bible Study, The Six Abodes of Satan, MBS 001, from Dr. Fruchtenbaum. And this will go through the six abodes of Satan. Just to quickly run through what's going to be presented in that manuscript. First of all, the first abodes were in the past. Number one was the throne of God, here in Ezekiel 28. And number two, the earth before the fall, here again in Ezekiel 28. Then the abode of God during the present, and presently Satan his abode is the atmospheric heavens, Ephesians 2 and chapter 6, verse 12. The future abode of Satan is number 4, the earth in Revelation 12. Then he's cast down to the abyss in Revelation 20. And finally, he's cast into the lake of fire in Revelation 20. So these are the six dwelling places of Satan during his career. All right, so at this point, let's move on to verse 13. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the ruby, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the lapis lazuli, the turquoise, and the emerald, and the gold. The workmanship of your settings and sockets was in you. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. All right, so you were in Eden, the garden of God. This is the second abode. Probably not the Eden of Genesis. That was a vegetable garden. This is a mineral garden. This is a mineral garden, and it's in heaven. This is the second abode. The first abode was with the throne of God. The second is on earth, in the mineral garden. Now, Ezekiel says, every precious stone was your covering. Now, that word covering means a canopy. These stones served as a covering, a canopy over the king of Tyre. So apparently, these stones also covered the earth as a mineral garden. So these stones seem to have a double purpose, covering the king of Tyre as a canopy in verse 13. And now as we get into verse 14, covering the earth in Genesis 1:1, so that the king of Tyre walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. We'll get to verse 14 in just a second. Now the stones were arranged in three sets of three plus one. Three sets of three plus one. Now the first set, and they resemble the breastplate of the high priest. The first set is very similar to the high priest's breastplate. It's a sardis, a topaz, and a diamond. Now there's a different stone. The third stone is a different stone in the high priest breastplate. It's a carbuncle. So again, it's similar, not the same thing. Now, the second set is similar to the fourth row of the priest, the high priest breastplate, but the gems are in a different order. It's the same stones, but a different order. The beryl, the onyx, and the jasper. Now, the third set of three is similar to the second row in the high priest's breastplate, Exodus 28:18. It's the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle in the high priest's breastplate. There, I'll get it out. The final jewel was a diamond. So that's three groups of three plus one, and the plus one is gold. Now, gold is a metal. It's not a stone. So this is a very similar, almost identical pattern with three of the four rows of the stones in the breastplate of the high priest. The high priest wore 12 stones in four rows of three. You can see them on the illustration here. While the king of Tyre has nine stones in three rows. And for the king of Tyre, it was a canopy rather than a breastplate. But it may indicate that the king of Tyre, Satan, had priestly functions. He may have had priestly functions as well. Now, a human priest represents men to God, and this may imply that Satan represented the angels before God. Now, this is only an implication. There's no clear-cut statement regarding this, so just keep that in mind. This is only an implication. God goes on to say, the workmanship of your tambourines and your flutes was in you. Now, these words, translated tambourines and flutes, differ in various renderings. They may refer to musical instruments. This may imply that the king of Tyre led in divine worship. Satan was the divine choir leader, something like that. But the NASB translates as different. They say perhaps it should be translated as your settings and your sockets. This will refer to the settings of the gems, the gold settings that held the stones in place and secure. But whatever they are, in the day that they were created, they were ready. In the day that Satan was created, they were ready. Now, this statement shows that he was a created being. He was an angel. He was an angel. He was not a human king, because a human king has to be born. Ethbaal had to be born. He wasn't just created. So this is Satan prior to his fall, prior to his fall. From the moment of his creation, all this was assigned to him. He had, and this is a summary of Satan here, he had perfection and wisdom and beauty. He had a canopy of stones. He had musical instruments or beautiful settings associated with him. So that was Satan before his fall. Now in verse 14, we come to his position during his first and second abode. Verse 14, you are the anointed cherub who covers, and I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. So you were the anointed cherub that covered. He was a cherub. This is the highest order of angelic beings. Earlier in Ezekiel, these were the bearers, the cherubim were the bearers of the Shekinah glory. They were the bearers of the throne of God. And here's that divine chariot that Ezekiel saw earlier. And there were four cherubim that, that bore the Shekinah glory. There's one, and there's two, and there's three, and there's four. They were the bearers of the throne of God, the divine chariot. But Satan is an anointed cherub. He's a special cherub. He's a Messiah cherub. He's the anointed one. This gave him a position of authority, authority that was superior to the other cherubs. So he became the arch cherub, as Michael is the archangel. So he had authority over the cherubim. He was the cherub that covered. And remember, this covering was a covering roof. The stones were his canopy, while he was a canopy himself over God. He was a canopy himself over God. Now, previously, cherubs were mentioned as being around and under the Shekinah glory, as you can see in the picture there. But at one time, this particular cherub was over it. He was over the top. He was the most prominent cherub of them all. God says, I set you over the holy mountain. This is his first abode. And God says, I sent you because this is a position given as a gift by God. It was a gift of grace. Satan didn't earn it. Now, the holy mountain of God, it's called holy because of the nature of the place. It's set apart for God's use, and it's called a mountain. And a mountain used symbolically is a symbol of a king, a kingdom, or a throne. So the holy mountain of God is the holy throne of God. Now this harks back to the description in Ezekiel chapter 1, as we're looking at this illustration here. There's the throne of God. Verses 26 through 28 describe the throne of God. So at one time, Satan was like a canopy, beautifying, honoring, and glorifying God's throne. He was over that very throne. Now note, Ezekiel did not see him. Ezekiel did not see him in his vision because Satan had already fallen and he's not been replaced. But before his fall, he controlled access to God. He had angelic authority. And then God says, you walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. This is the second abode restated. And walking to and fro and up and down is a common figure for satanic activity. For example, Job 1:7 and 2:2. The Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from roaming about on the earth and walking on it. So he was active in patrolling his dominion, the earth. Now, this concept of walking about typifies the activity of angels in general. For example, Zechariah 1:11. So they answered the angel of the Lord who was standing among the myrtle trees and said, we have patrolled the earth. And behold, all the earth is peaceful and quiet. So these angels were active. And then in Zechariah 6:7, when the strong ones went out, they were eager to go to patrol the earth. And he said, go, patrol the earth. And they patrolled the earth. So same idea. They were active. These angels were active in their mission of overseeing the earth. And there's a New Testament example in John chapter 1:51. He said to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. So here we see that angels seem to be in constant motion. They're very active. Now, he walks about in the midst of the stones of fire. Now, quite possibly, this is the original earth in Genesis 1:11, and that's his second abode. But a discussion of this particular subject belongs to a study of Genesis, so we won't go any further with this idea. Instead, we'll move on to verse 15, which deals with Satan's perfection. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. You were perfect in all your ways. The word perfect there is the word tamim. The word tamim means without any flaws. He was created without any flaws. So his actions were as perfect as his being. He had a physical frame, and mental abilities and actions were all consistent. They were all perfect, everything. And that was from the day they were created. And for a second time, we see that he's a created being. This is not Ethbaal, who was a naturally born being. This is from the day that God created him. So God created Satan perfect, perfect in physical frame, perfect in mental abilities, perfect in actions. And this shows that the fault does not lie with God. For in the very day he was created, he was perfect in everything, as well as his action. And the corruption of his person and actions came subsequent, after his creation. And then he was held responsible for his corruption. He had a free will. He made a responsible decision, and he was held accountable for that responsible decision. So in the beginning he was perfect until unrighteousness was found in him. This is the closest the Bible comes to giving, to telling us the origin of sin. And note, its origin, however, is Satan, not God. God did not create sin. So unrighteousness was not, so perfection was found in him until, subsequent, after the creation, subsequent to his exhibiting and showing perfection of person by his perfection of deeds. So his unrighteousness is described as wrongdoings. The word means wrong actions. And this perfection of his ways and deeds had given way to wrong deeds and wrong actions. So this presupposes a corruption of the person. First, of the character. Both the corruption of person and the wrongdoings are described in verses 16 through 19. And God says, it was found in you. One day, there was this corruption. And now we transfer our transition to a new topic, which is the fall of the king of Tyre, in verses 16 through 19. So the wrongdoings come to the fore in verse 16. By the abundance of your trade, you were internally, notice, that's where it begins, you were internally filled with violence, and you sinned. Now, for the prince of Tyre, Ethbaal, trade meant, the abundance of your trade meant going from port to port gathering wealth, in verse 5. But for the king of Tyre, the abundance of your trade meant going from angel to angel, bad-mouthing God, and seeking angelic loyalty. Eventually, he convinced one-third of the angelic host to follow him, Revelation 12:4. Then another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems, and his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven, and threw them to the earth. Now a star used symbolically is a symbol of angels. And thus, through this rebellion, Satan became the father of lies. John 8:44. You are of your father the devil, and you want to do the desire of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning, and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. He was the first liar. And he traded from angel to angel. And eventually, Satan led a revolt in heaven. He began the angelic conflict that will continue until the middle of the tribulation. Revelation chapter 12, 7 through 9. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough. And there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And he was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. So the angelic conflict is going on right now, and it will continue until the middle of the tribulation. God says to him, you had sinned, you sinned. That word sin means to miss the mark. Satan, as a result, missed the mark of his high calling. So Satan was the first sinner, not Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve were the first of humanity to sin. But Satan was the first being, the first created being to sin. And then he went out after Adam and Eve, who were two other perfect beings. And he apparently hated perfection now that he wasn't perfect. So now we come to the judgment of the king of Tyre. The judgment of the king of Tyre. Verse 16. Therefore I have cast you as profane from the mountain of God. and I have destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Therefore, that's a very important word, because of verse 16a, he lost his position in the first abode, heaven. The perfect cherub became the profane cherub. He's no longer the guardian of God's throne. He does not appear in Ezekiel's vision. Again, Revelation 12, 7 through 9. The great dragon was thrown down, the serpent of old, who was called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth. The angels were thrown down with him. So he no longer is associated with the divine chariot, the throne of God. He's been thrown out of heaven. And God says, I've destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. This is a loss of position in his second abode, which again was heaven. He's called, O covering cherub. This is a loss of position in priestly and worship functions. If, of course, these implications from verse 13 are accurate, which I think they are. But it seemed that he lost priestly and worship functions. He was destroyed, not in his being, but being cast out from the Garden of Eden. He was cast out from the midst of the stones of fire. Now, Satan is not annihilated. Rather, he is destroyed by expulsion. He will exist forever, but he will exist in a state called spiritual death. Now, let's see. How much time do I have here? Do I have enough time to finish up verse 17, to go into verse 17? All right, let's try to finish up verse 17. And in verse 17, we look at the corruption of his being. This is the downward fall of his character. He looked upon his beauty. Let's read verse 17. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. So he looked upon his beauty, and he allowed pride to set in. He did exactly what the prince of Tyre would do centuries later. He exalted himself. He glorified himself. And so this first sin was pride, and the first sinner was Satan. And he corrupted the beauty of his brightness. His beauty wrongly viewed. Beauty is fine. Nothing wrong with beauty. But wrongly viewed, it led to pride. And he can still appear beautiful today. He can still appear beautiful. 2 Corinthians 11, 14 and 15. No wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it's not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end will be according to their deeds. So he can appear beautiful today. And the pride was sin, and the sin corrupted his perfect wisdom of verse 12. And his great wisdom is now used for sinful purposes instead of righteous purposes. And James, in chapter 1, lays out the progression of sin for us. James says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil. And he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by what? His own lust. It happens inside. That's where it starts. Happens inside us. Then when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. This is indicative of the past fall of Satan through pride. And when sin is accomplished, this is indicative of Satan's career today. It brings forth death. And this is indicative of Satan's future destiny in the lake of fire. And you know, to some degree, Satan can no longer think straight. You know, he and his cohorts know the Bible. For example, Luke 4, 33 and 34. In the synagogue, there was a man possessed by the spirit of an unclean demon. And he cried out with a loud voice, let us alone. What business do we have with each other, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. He knows who Yeshua is. He's not in the dark. Mark 1:34, and he, Yeshua, healed many who were ill with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he was not permitting the demons to speak. Why? Because they knew who he was. So Satan and his cohorts know the Bible, and yet they think they can still win by killing the Jewish people. Revelation 12, 12 and 13. For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that his time, he only has a short time. So he knows the Bible. He knows time's getting short. It's coming toward the end. What does he do? And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. So he's attacking the national promise. He's trying to kill the Jewish people. He thinks he can still win by killing the Jewish people. So he's attacking the national promise of the Abrahamic covenant. Here's the Abrahamic covenant. And this is the leg of the Abrahamic covenant that he's attacking. If I can just destroy the Jewish people, then God can't fulfill the Abrahamic covenant and my career is safe. This is a huge mistake in his thinking. He believes his own lie. He believes his own lie. That's the corruption of his being. All right, at this point, I think I will call it quits. We're in the middle of verse 17, and we're going to change time frames at this point. We're going to change time frames and look at the punishment of the king of Tyre in the second part of verse 17. So I think this is a fairly decent spot to quit. I think we're out of time anyway. So we'll see you next session when we look at the punishment of the king of Tyre. Thanks so much for being our students. We'll see you next session. Lahithraot. Lahithraot.